Recording from my living room in beautiful Marietta, Georgia, you are listening to the Think Inclusive Podcast, Episode 11, brought to you by Brooks Publishing Company. I'm your host, Tim Villegas. Today, I will be speaking with Debbie Taub, an expert in the field of special education alternate assessment. For those of you who don't know, alternate assessment is the state test or portfolio that is administered or collected for students with the most significant cognitive disabilities, around 1-2% of all students in a typical school district. I had the pleasure of visiting with her one evening in February of this year. Debbie and I discuss what exactly is alternate assessment and what it's supposed to measure. In addition, we talk about how alternate assessment might be a gateway to more inclusive schools. At the end of the podcast, Debbie lists some resources that may be helpful for any educator who wants to know more about modifying grade-level curriculum for students with significant disabilities. All in all, we had a great conversation. So without further ado, let's get to the Think Inclusive Podcast. Thanks for listening. Joining me on the Think Inclusive Podcast today is Debbie Taub. She is the Director of Research at Keystone Alternate Assessment. Dr. Taub has designed, implemented, and evaluated alternate assessments for students with significant cognitive disabilities, developed standards-based curricula and instruction, and conducted validity and alignment evaluations. This work is informed by her experience as a classroom teacher and school reform specialist. She has contributed journal articles, book chapters, and numerous professional development trainings to the field of educating children with complex needs, and has presented internationally on working with students who have autism. She is an advisory member of the Council to Promote Self-Determination Education and Workforce Committee, and an active member of the TASH Inclusive Education Committee. In addition, she is a member of the Council for Exceptional Children's CCSS Advisory Group and is a representative for TASH on the National Center on Universal Design for Learning's Task Force. So welcome to the podcast, Debbie. Thank you very much for taking time to speak with us.
Well, thank you so much for having me. As I said, I really love your work, so I'm excited to be here.
Well, thanks. Good. Well, guess what? I just completed, I am a teacher, and I just completed my alternate assessment for my kiddos. So that is a big, relief off of my shoulders. And I know that for the educators that know what alternate assessment is and do administer in whatever way, in whatever state they're in, it can be a challenge depending on, where you are and what you do. For the people that don't really know what alternate assessment is, I know that there's a lot of people that know what assessment is. They have state testing and there's benchmark testing and everything like that. That seems to be familiar to everybody. How would you, as someone who works in the field, describe alternate assessment and what it is and what it's supposed to do?
Wow, that's a lot of things. Okay. So,
you can just tackle one thing, I guess. So,
when we talk about alternate assessments, we're talking about your large-scale state assessments. So not the things that happen in your classroom, not the ones in just for classroom instruction, not the ones you use to look at your IEP goals, not the ones you use as a formative assessment, but the ones that are used for annual yearly progress under the ESEA federal regulations. Otherwise, there's No Child Left Behind. And there are a couple different ways that students can participate in assessments for AYP. One, they can take the assessment that most kids are taking, the general assessment without accommodations. Mm-hmm. Two, they can take the general assessment, but with accommodations. Some states have a 2% modified assessment that the federal feds are trying to kind of phase out. Mm-hmm. So I won't really talk about that one. And then the other way is that they can take what's known as an alternate assessment based on alternate achievement standards. And that's for, as you said, the kids with the most significant cognitive disabilities. Right now, every state has a different assessment. Some people are using portfolios. Some people are using performance tasks. Some people are using a combination of observations and checklists. So there's a lot of different ways that states have built their alternate assessments. There are two consortia right now that are building alternate assessments based on the Common Core State Standards. Mm-hmm. They're called Dynamic Learning Maps, or DLM, and the National Centers and State Collaborative, or NCSIC. So that's kind of your basic introduction to alternate assessments. I'm trying to think what the rest of that question was. what are they supposed to do?
Well, yeah, I guess, you know, let's back up and say, you know, why should we test students with the most significant disabilities? You know, that's a question, yeah, actually I hear a lot.
Yeah, and I hear it a ton. So let me start with this. I think that there are problems right now with our accountability system, and there are things that we need to do differently as a country around education. Mm-hmm. But that being said, I have become a firm believer in the importance of assessing all kids. And I want to say, I used to teach at the college level, and I was one of those professors who stood up in front of my students and said, I can't believe this No Child Left Behind thing. They're going to make us test these kids. What are they thinking? They're ridiculous. Mm-hmm. I was furious. Mm-hmm. And I started really looking into it, and what changed my mind was I was doing some school reform work in a school that was really not doing well by its students. And the principal said to me, you know, I have all these special education teachers, half my school is special education, but I know nothing about special education, so I kind of just let them do what they want to do. But I need to change that because we're not doing well as a school. We're not doing well at all. And that's what AYP is showing us now, that we have to assess all these kids. It's showing me that I'm not doing well by the kids. Mm-hmm. So we need to fix that. Come help me do that. And I went into this one classroom, and it was a fifth grade classroom, and their math class was to color triangles green. And that's what they did for 2 weeks, was just color triangles green. And this is a very good teacher in many ways, but that's what she knew to do for math for these students, was focus on identifying triangles over and over and over again. Mm-hmm. So I worked with her, and we talked about how you could make a standards-based lesson that would actually, this state had a portfolio system, so how could you make a standards-based lesson that met the student's needs but was connected to the grade level standards? And within 3 months, and not even that long, within 6 weeks, she came back to me and she said, I never would have believed it. This kid can do multiplication. This kid is doing, like, great things, and he just needed different supports, and he needed me to think about the content differently. And that's what had me start thinking about what, okay, maybe these assessments are not the evil thing I thought they were. And I'm hearing those kinds of stories all over the country of students who, once challenged and provided with the accommodations and supports that they needed, they started getting more and more academics. And then, and this is the part I really love about it, those same teachers were saying to me, well, so if my kid can work on the same kinds of things with modifications and with supports and with accommodations, why do I have them in a segregated classroom? Mm-hmm. They should be with their peers.
Yep.
So alternate assessments for me became a really powerful way to help promote inclusive practices. Mm-hmm. And I love that aspect of it. I never thought I would say that I love anything about an assessment system, but like I loved that aspect of the alternate assessment system, was that it could help provide better education for some of the students, higher expectations, a higher level of presumed competence, and then some teachers who never would have thought of inclusion for these particular students. Even if they thought of inclusion for other students, they might not have thought of it for these kids. They started thinking, oh, well, yeah, if I had these supports and accommodations, sure, we could do that. So it became less about why my student can't, but rather, what can I do to get my kid there?
Right. And you know, that way of thinking was actually what turned me around on the concept of alternate assessment. I don't want to talk too much about the way that Georgia does it, because I might just rant the entire evening.
As you
But
said, there are some problems.
But you know, like I've told my colleagues, who do like to rant to me, that I say, look, it's not that I have anything against alternate assessment. I like alternate assessment. It's just the way that we do it, and also the systems that are set up to support it. It makes complete sense to me that giving access to the general curriculum to students with significant disabilities should be done in a general education classroom or in an inclusive setting. It does not make that much sense to me to do it in a segregated classroom or a self-contained classroom, which you know, which I am a teacher of. So it's, you know, and one way that I've kind of worked around it when I've been able to is to do some like a hybrid type of co-teaching model where I would bring in like a fifth grade classroom along with the teacher, and we would do a like a co-taught lesson based on standards, you know, for fifth grade, like a physical change and chemical change or something like that. And we would do this science lesson where we would you know, using the principles of universal design, have a meaningful activity for my students as well as the typical fifth grade students, and then be able to use that for the alternate assessment. And that to me is the best way I have found to kind of get that done in a way that I think is meaningful, where I'm not just teaching in a vacuum. And that's what I've been trying to tell my colleagues, is that when we do this in our room, when it's just us, I do feel like we're teaching in a vacuum.
And that was one of the things about, the state I was working in with that particular teacher. One of the performance dimensions of their assessment system was different settings. Was the student able to generalize their skills and do these things in different settings? And peer interactions. Did they have interactions with peers who didn't have disabilities? And those things counted towards the student's score. Now that's unfortunately not included in most assessment systems for AYP anymore. Some states may still include those dimensions for their state information, but it's not reported to the federal government. Which is a shame, I think, because I think, just like you're saying, those are some of the most, we know, research tells us that students who take alternate assessments need help generalizing. They do better when they are in with their same age peers and peers without disabilities. So by taking out those dimensions, I think I understand why they did it in terms of reliability and validity, but I think for our population of students, it may not have been the best decision. It's because we do what we're tested on sometimes. And so for some teachers, it took out that requirement of saying, oh, I could do this in a gen ed science class. Let's go do that.
Right, exactly. Yeah, I think, it's definitely hard when you have multi-age or multi-grade self-contained classrooms, and you are trying to generalize with, in general education, with that kind of varied age group. So, and like I said, I don't know how other states do it, but I think that's like the mechanics of it, the pragmatics of it, is what most people have a problem with. It's not necessarily the theory behind it. So, The couple questions come to mind. One is how much does how students do on alternate assessment, how much does that affect AYP? Because I've heard a number of different things.
It depends on the school and it depends on the state. So, for instance, the school I was working in, or one of the schools I was working in, since half their kids were in alternate assessment, it made a big difference if their kids scored well in an alternate assessment. The schools that only have a couple of kids who take the alternate, which, if you're in a neighborhood school, that's what the natural proportions should be, usually are, is you just have a few kids.
Right.
Then the alternate assessment for that school doesn't do too much for changing the overall AYP scores. It may change, because they also report out by subgroups, so it may affect the subgroup scores, And for the state as a whole, we'll see what happens with these new assessments, but certainly there was a trend for a long time of students on the alternate assessment doing better than students on the general assessment. More students were scoring proficient advanced than the students in the general assessment. So it's hard to say, and I think it's an interesting question. I think that the myth that students on the alternate pull down the scores is just that. It's a myth. We don't really have any evidence to show that on a large scale,
Right.
but that's what happens.
Yeah, I know that that's a concern. That's something that, administrators definitely, at least worry about. Whether like you said, if it is a myth, but it's something that at least gets talked about. What I would also like to know is what kinds of alternate assessments are there currently? I've mentioned before that Georgia, and I believe Alabama, right next door, is a portfolio assessment. How many other states that you're aware of are doing portfolio and other kinds? If you know.
Well, here's the problem with that question for me. It's that one state calls a portfolio, another state calls a performance task or a checklist. So there's not necessarily a straight answer to that.
Okay.
I can tell you that many, many states are doing some form of portfolio, meaning that the teacher teaches a lesson, collects the work, and then scores that work, and that work is used to help inform what the alternate assessment scores are. Some people have a portfolio where they videotape the students, and then an outside, not the teacher, an outside scorer scores it. So there's a lot of different ways that people have kind of taken that term portfolio and made it their own. So it's hard to say, but in general, there's portfolios where you have teacher-created and teacher-collected work. There's performance tasks where it's like an item on a task, but the student has to do different steps, different skills and concepts, perform different skills and concepts. But all the students are kind of given the same task. How they access those tasks may differ based on their communication system or their needs, but they're all given the same tasks, and then teachers can take that information, and usually they'll include some evidence to support their score of how the student did on that task. There's also performance checklists, which just have a list of all the different things that the kids in the alternate may be doing, or students in the alternate may be doing or should be doing at that grade level or grade band, and the teacher just checks it off, and then maybe they turn in a piece of evidence or two or three for one or two of those checklists pieces. Mm-hmm. There's very few kind of item-based alternative assessments at the moment where, you know, you have a multiple choice question and you answer A, B, and C. That may be part of somebody's performance task. It may be part of somebody's portfolio, but it's not generally the sole measure of how a student's doing.
Mm-hmm.
Sorry, I can't answer specifically numbers on that one, though.
No, that's fine. That's fine. Because as an educator, I only know what's either around me or what I've experienced. So mm-hmm. I know that other people are curious, you know, as to that. Here's another question, a kind of a history-based question about alternate assessment. How long have we had alternate assessment in the United States?
The passage of No Child Left Behind, which was, 1997, I think?
That sounds right to me.
So since then, that's when we've had kind of federally mandated alternate assessments. Now, Kentucky started an alternate assessment system before that, because if you look at IDEA, one of the things IDEA says is that all students need to be included in instruction and accountability systems. And so Kentucky said, well, all means all, we're going to create a form of alternate assessment. So Kentucky was actually one of the first states to build an alternate assessment.
Wow.
And yeah. And so they did it before it was required under No Child Left Behind. But we've had them for quite a while. And one of the things that I think is really important about alternate assessments, and one of the reasons that it worries me when people talk about getting rid of alternate assessments, and not the federal government, not states, but when people are grumpy and they say we should just get rid of all of these things.
Right.
One of the things that worries me is we have learned so much about this population of students in the past, 10, 15 years,
mm-hmm.
that we never knew before, because it just wasn't what we focused on. So for instance, when the alternate assessment started, we used to talk about how the students who make up the 1% of the population who can achieve proficiency on the alternate assessment actually make up 99% of the diversity within schools, meaning that they are the most diverse group of kids you'll ever get together. And yet, if you look at the research, Kleiner and Kearns and Toles Reeves did some research on learner characteristics of students who take alternate assessments, and they've now done that research across 26 states, and the averages across those states have been pretty much the same in every state. About 80% of those students who take the alternate assessment are using some form of symbolic communication, whether it be an AAC device or sign language or Braille or words. They're using some form of communication system, symbolic communication, excuse me.
Mm-hmm.
Approximately, let me see if I can pull up the numbers really quickly, but approximately 70 to 80% of the kids are reading at some level, whether it be basic sight words or being able to read and answer questions. Some of the kids in the alternate are actually able to answer pretty high-level questions, not just basic recall, but more instancing kinds of questions, which is interesting.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. So what we're finding is all this information about these students and also leading us to think about how do they best learn and what can we do to help them learn better and how do we present information to these students in a way that's meaningful to them and useful to them, but also that helps push our expectations as population students. One of the things that I think is really powerful to think about is a lot of teachers really struggle with that I want to teach my kid just functional skills.
Mm-hmm.
You know, why should I teach anything else? They just need to learn functional skills. And I have two big answers to that. One is, first of all, what's more functional than reading and math?
True.
And especially in this day and age, what is more functional than reading and math? And problem solving. And figuring out, if I don't know the answer, what do I do? Where do I go? Like, those are all things I taught my students. And I worked as a job coach for a while, and I can't tell you how many times I stood in front of audiences training on alternate assessments, and very, very concerned teachers came to me and said, well, I just don't understand why I should ever teach my kid an idiom. That's not what I need to work on in their life. They need to get a job. They need to do this. They need to do that. That's not what they should be working on. And I said, well, I understand what you're saying, but as a job coach, when my client's boss said to them, hey, you need to shake a leg, I needed my client to work faster, not stand there and shake a leg. That's why it's important to teach my clients idioms. Like, that's why this is vital. And also just for inclusive practices in the community. I want my students to grow up, and I taught elementary school, so, you know, I didn't have transition age students when I was teaching. Mm-hmm. But I wanted them to grow up and have friends and do things and go in the community and have a job and live in the community. So I wanted them to be able to have a conversation where they weren't thrown by words that weren't literal.
Mm-hmm.
And then the other piece of the I should only teach functional skills, that's what we know, that's what we know works. When our field first started teaching students with the most complex needs functional skills, there was no research to back up that that was a good idea. We just, as educators, looked at the outcomes for our students and said, gosh, you know, teaching these developmental stages is not getting our students jobs. It's not getting them to be as productive in the communities we want them to be. It's not getting them outcomes of friends and all of these other things. So there has to be a different way. So they started looking at teaching functional skills and this idea that we should look at what is it my student needs in the next natural setting to be successful. Those are the skills I should be working on now. Hmm. So I understand the concern and I hear that concern, but I think we need to take a step back and look at what do we really want for our students and how do we want to help them achieve that. And also, I think once in a while it's good to let go of things. You know, I've been in high school classrooms where they're still working on identifying the letters of the alphabet. Because the student doesn't know the letters of the alphabet, and how will they ever learn to read if they don't know the letters of the alphabet? Well, if I'm in high school and I don't know the letters of the alphabet, maybe it's time to give me some kind of different support to help me read and understand.
Right, exactly. So. I think that, you know, it's very difficult as an educator when you have been teaching for a certain way for so long. Mm-hmm. You know, to hear anybody talk about doing it a different way, especially, you know, if I had been in the teaching profession for 30 years, and because that's what we started to do, you know, when you first got in the field, that's what you did. You worked on functional skills and you worked on life skills. I mean, that's what you call it, you know, a life skills curriculum. And that's actually what we still call it sometimes. how do you think, or, you know, what is the best way to help people change their mindset? Because I think for a lot of educators, they just don't have any concept of what you're talking about. Okay, I'm supposed to be teaching them, you know, I'm supposed to be teaching them multiplication. Right.
Mm-hmm.
How exactly am I supposed to do that? What advice do you give teachers, or what resource, or what exactly do you tell teachers to help change their mindset?
Well, It's a hard question because one of the things, so one of the other pieces of work that I do, and I really love it, is I help states and school districts build inclusive systems. And one of the things that research has shown us and that practice has shown us is that you can't always change beliefs until you've changed outcomes, which means I can talk until I'm blue in the face about how important it is for kids to be included and how important it is for us to teach academics. But until teachers see, or not even just teachers, but family members who are concerned or administrators who are concerned, until they see positive outcomes, to some people they're not going to change their mind until they see those positive outcomes. So
right.
Sometimes you have to change the behavior before you can change the attitude and the belief. So one of the things that I do is and often when I'm in those situations, I'm in those situations because I've been brought in to help people teach grade level content that's or grade level aligned content.
Right.
And so one of the things I'll say is, okay, we can have this philosophical discussion, but in the end, the law says you have to teach grade level aligned content. That's what we're supposed to be doing. So let me help you do that. I will support you in whatever way I can. I'm happy to brainstorm with you. I'm happy to problem solve with you. I'm happy to put you in touch with other resources. There's lots of great trainings online. There's lots of great resources online. I don't want teachers to have to recreate the wheel every time you go to lessons, especially not in this day and age. There's so many ways to share resources and share information. Let's do it.
Absolutely.
So if I have a teacher who's working on teaching Romeo and Juliet or Huckleberry Finn, I can point you to three or four different places where you can get adapted text online for free to help you do that.
Mm-hmm.
Those lessons, both of the consortia, NICSIC and DLM, are building sample lessons and professional development resources for teachers on just that question: how do I teach aligned content to students with the most complex instructional needs, students with the most significant cognitive disabilities? How do I do that?
Hmm.
So there's resources through both those consortia websites on how to do that. I'm trying to think where else. I mean, Keystone has a webpage just filled with resources that we try to collect each time we go out on trainings or conferences, or anytime I learn things from other people. We try to collect all the different resources and then put them up on our website. Here's some free resources on how to build communication systems. Here's free resources on how to teach math. Here's free resources on how to do science. You know, just whatever I can put into people's hands to make their lives a little easier, I am absolutely happy to do that and want to do that. So that's usually my approach. Just let's get down and dirty in terms of figuring out how to make this work, because it shouldn't be about should the student not. It should be about how.
Right,
there are
exactly.
So many places and resources and technologies and supports out there. It's about how in this day and age.
Talking a little bit, you know, or I guess changing the focus a little bit to the general concept of inclusive education. What is your feeling? Mm-hmm. What is your feeling about where we are going, just as educational system in the United States? Do you feel like the move towards inclusive education is kind of this inevitable thing that's going to happen? Or do we still need some key things to happen? Like, you know, for instance, you know, do we need more specific legislation about LRE and, you know, in IDEA? Or do we need, you know, what exactly do we need to push this forward?
Wow, you asked a hard question.
I'm sorry. I didn't provide you with that one beforehand, so.
I say that because I'm having that conversation, I feel like almost daily now, with people at TASH and on the Inclusive Ed Committee and with various people who I'm working on some papers with. what do we need to do to move inclusive practices forward? Is it something that needs to be mandated from the feds, which I'm not sure will ever happen because as a country, and especially in certain states, we are very tied to this idea of local control and also to parental choice. So
absolutely.
So you can't really mandate that all kids be included. And then there are some people who would struggle with how does that look? And that's hard. So you'd have to really put in a lot of support for the whole system across the nation to make inclusive practices successful, or else what's going to happen is we're going to mandate it. Some people are going to fail miserably, and then it's going to become the impetus for saying, well, of course it's failing. It just doesn't work at all. And we know that's not true. We know that when it is done well and when it is done with the appropriate supports and in the appropriate way, then all students do better. Students with and without disabilities do better.
Right. I think it's a very nuanced conversation, and it's a lot more nuanced than people give it credit for. I've often said that inclusion advocates are probably one of the most misunderstood people in the education reform movement, because we kind of have this mantra of all means all, right?
Mm-hmm.
And when people hear that, they automatically equate it to the civil rights movement. And so, you know, there are some differences between the civil rights movement and the inclusive education movement or the disability rights movement. They're very similar and they're parallel in as far as I'm concerned. There are systems and supports that need to be in place for us to be successful at inclusive education, you know, and that's something that you touched on. When we decide and we mandate and we say, okay, we are getting rid of all self-contained classrooms in every school across the country, some counties and some school districts will absolutely thrive in that, in that situation. But like you said, others will fail miserably. And it's just because, I mean, there's 100 reasons why, you know? So, I think having that conversation and admitting that is a really good thing, because people need to hear that that's not what we're trying to do. At least I think the people that are really serious about doing it right, that's not what we want to do. I had a conversation with this Englishman, Alan Scher, who I've written about, and he wrote a play called The Death of a Nightingale, and how they went about moving inclusive education forward in the UK was very much, let's get rid of all special schools, all self-contained classrooms, and let's do it now. And you have some parents who were very upset by that, and educators. And so I want to make sure that as the United States moves forward, which I believe that we should, which we should do, that we need to do it smartly and with the correct supports. And that's why I love the Swift schools, and I love, you know, all the coalitions for inclusive education all around the country, you know, just kind of beating the drum and waking people up to that this is a good thing. But I also don't want to go the way of, you know, setting us up for failure. You know what I mean?
Absolutely. And I think that I've been lucky to be part of some really great, exciting work in different states. And one state I'm working with, one of the ways that they're helping their center-based schools see the power of inclusive practices is they're approaching it from we know you have to teach these new standards. We know you have to teach grade level aligned, you know, content aligned to these standards and aligned to grade level, which is something that some of you may not have done. So here's some supports we can give you. And one of those supports is connecting you with content specialists and with other schools. And through kind of pathways like that, these schools are, and these teachers in these schools and the administrators are starting to see, wow, it's not that bad. It's not that scary. We might be able to do this. And that's one of the things that really has become concerning to me in the past few years. I have a friend who called me up one day, and her daughter has been in an inclusive school or an inclusive class, which I always thought was kind of weird, but she was in an inclusive class and she has some language concerns and she has ADHD. But nowhere near as significant as the kids you and I would work with. I mean, typically in our day.
Right.
And she called me one day and she was in tears and she said, I was just pulled aside by the principal and the teacher. And they told me my daughter needs to go into a special ed segregated classroom next year because she's just too not doing well in this classroom.
Mm-hmm.
And I was floored and I went to visit the school and see what was going on and talk to them. And the fear mongering that they instilled into this poor parent, I was horrified.
Yeah.
Because what they kept saying in the nicest possible way they could was, if you put your child with this special education teacher, she's going to be nice to them, to her. If you put your kid with the general ed teacher, she won't be nice to her.
Right.
And right. I think that kind of fear-mongering that some schools or teachers, and I don't know that they do it intentionally, but it's so easy as a parent to want, I mean, it's not even easy. As a parent, you want what's best for your kid. And as a relatively new parent, I'm certainly learning whole new aspects of this in my life. But when somebody says to you, if you put your kid in this segregated classroom, they're going to get all these other wonderful therapies and all these other wonderful services. But there's no reason, and there was no expectation in writing the least restrictive environment laws and statutes. There was no expectation that that had to happen in the segregated classroom. That was supposed to be a continuum of services, not necessarily a continuum of placement.
Mm.
And yet some people have really kind of bought into or truly believe in this idea of the continuum of placements, and that if you're in the segregated placement, that's where you get the most services.
Right.
And there's no way they can envision putting those services into a general ed setting. And then the outcome of that is telling parents, well, they're going to get a better education if they're over there. Well, research shows they're not going to get a better education if they're over there. You know, they're going to get a different education. But if you want your child to have access to the content, you know, Michael Waymire did some really interesting research on levels of, and I'm blanking on the word, it's not levels, but like how well students were given access to the content.
Right.
And it's done much better in the general ed setting.
Well, yeah, of course, because
even for
yeah.
our kids.
Yeah, well, that's something that I've talked to my colleagues too. Is that as a self-contained teacher, I understand the pace of my classroom, and the pace mm-hmm. is slow. You know,
mm-hmm.
I mean, I physically cannot run my classroom like a general ed classroom because I have. You know, I have things that need to happen,
right.
whether they're physical, you know, needs that are taken mm-hmm. care of or whatever. I don't want to go too much into detail, but
right.
But when you have, you know, one of my students in a general education room, it's just things are flying, you know, and the content
yeah.
is flying, and they're exposed to so much that they would never be exposed in my classroom, even if I did teach all the standards, all day, every day. You know what I mean?
Oh yeah. You've got so many things going on in your classroom. And I think one of the other pieces of that is we also have a lot of teachers who, for whatever reason, didn't have to take content courses in order to get their degrees in special education. So I know I chose to take, as an elective, I took courses in teaching reading and teaching math, but it was not a requirement in the program I went through. Like, how is that possible? And then I would be in charge of teaching my kids content?
Well, isn't that a problem with our teacher training? Well, that's, I mean, okay, there's a problem with teacher training, I think, in general, right? But then there's also a problem with teacher training in the field of special education. And and I got my credentials in moderate severe disabilities, but so that's what I'm most familiar with. But I know that there's issues when you're talking about mild dis or learning disabilities and how they teach and the standards, for the programs. So that's probably a whole other show.
I think it is. Education is such a complex being, and I remember when I first started doing education research, I struggled with this idea of causal effects in education because I can say that all these teachers went to like X professional development and that caused them to change their teaching behaviors and then that caused their students' scores to go up and their knowledge about Shakespeare to improve. But it could also be 40 other things. It could be that they all happen to take the same theater class and that theater class informed their understanding of Shakespeare. It could be that there was a Shakespeare festival in their town that all of their parents took them to. It could be, so there's so many factors that go into a child and their education. It's hard to say it's this one piece. And yet we have such clear correlational data that shows that kids with all disabilities and kids without disabilities do better in inclusive settings. But it's hard to make that quantitative because you have to take in all these other variables.
Well, that isn't only a special education problem.
No, it's definitely not.
That is a just a in a general way a education problem, because
It
they're
is.
dealing with that with just with testing and with the different states. I think that I think that in that way we have something in common. Those that are in the field of special education, we have that in common that we can go to our general ed, colleagues, and we can talk about the same issues that they're dealing with. And something that I've really just learned, in the last few years is that when you actually do create relationships with your general ed colleagues, that you become a better teacher. It's so easy to be the self-contained teacher, and no one expects anything from you. You're just with those kids, and no one knows what you do. You might as well you might as well, I don't know, be doing whatever you want, and they would never know it. But once you start opening yourself up to having those relationships and maybe creating those co-teaching partners, and it just changes your perspective. I think so. I'm for inclusive education, but also, I'm also for including yourself in your school community as an educator, because I think that is huge, and not just sitting at the special ed table.
No, I think you're absolutely right. It's very very big to for teachers to take that. Really lucky when I first started teaching. So I was a little naive. I will admit that. So when I first started teaching, I didn't realize that not everybody did inclusion, because where I went to school and all the places where I had worked when I was teaching and student teaching and doing volunteer work, and I worked in several different early childhood intervention programs, they all did inclusion. So I just naively assumed that's what everybody did.
Right.
So I got my first job, and I went into the school, and I started talking to all these teachers about when I was going to be in their classroom and how I was going to work it and all these other things. And it wasn't until halfway through the year, and I was really struggling with this one teacher, and we just were having a tough time working together. And I said to her, explain to me why this is so hard, because I'm not understanding what you need. And she looked at me and she said, you know, nobody's ever done this inclusion thing before. I took these kids and let them be in my class because I assumed that I'd never see them. And I went back to the other teachers I worked with and I said, wait a minute. So you guys didn't do this last year? And they said, oh, no, no, no. You know, everybody just took their kids and took them out, and that's what we did. Hmm. And I was like, oh, my God. Oh, my God. So nobody's ever done this before. And yet I look at how much I learned from those other teachers. Strategies I never would have thought to use,
right.
Concepts I never would have thought to teach, skills I never, and lessons that I got, the most amazing lessons on how to teach science. And I was so lucky. I got to work with, you know, one of the science teachers of the year in our state. So I got all these great science lessons from her. I worked with a woman who was like a 25-year veteran in teaching math, and she had fantastic strategies for teaching math that I never would have thought of.
Mm.
And so I look back at that and I think, thank God I was so naive that I just assumed I'd be in these classrooms, because that interaction with those teachers taught me so much more than I ever would have learned if I had just gone into a classroom and closed my door.
Yeah, that's a great point. That's a great point. In fact, that's one of the things that has helped me in actually teaching content to my kids is not looking up, you know, lesson plans on the computer, but to go to my fourth grade counterpart and say, how would you teach mm-hmm. this lesson? Because I have no idea,
right.
You know, and then they would say, oh, you do this or this, or, you know, or this is how mm-hmm. I would teach it to my kids. And then it makes sense, like, oh, I can adapt that, you know, for,
yep.
you know, this student or this student. I really wish
right.
I had the time to do that more. And I think that's part of the issue too, is that collaboration mm-hmm. piece. We just don't get enough time to do that. You know, there's a lot of things that, you know, I wish we had more of, but that's definitely something,
yeah.
you know, that whole collaboration. So that definitely resonates with me, with what
yeah.
you're talking about.
And I do think that for those states moving to the Common Core state standard, if they're going to do that and they're going to do it right, collaboration should be something they're all looking into, because that's one of the big points of Common Core, is that you're supposed to be teaching literacy across content areas.
Mm-hmm.
So that means you better have teachers talking to each other, or else how will you know that you're covering all those standards? How will you know you're addressing all those issues? How will you know that your students are getting a holistic education? And that includes special education.
Right.
We have so much to teach general ed teachers too.
Well, yeah. And I think that's, you know, it's all part of it. It's getting mm-hmm. It's getting those conversations going, and also having them see special ed teachers as real teachers. You know, I think that's you know, been part of it. And you know, we seclude ourselves. Mm-hmm. So,
mm-hmm.
and I can only I can speak for myself, because that, you know, because I have done
right.
that before. Well, I want to wrap up with one more question. This has been an awesome conversation. Thanks again for being with us.
Well, thank you again for having me. This has been fun.
So I want to know, for a teacher or educator, or even parent that is struggling to figure out where do I go to learn more about how I can give access to the curriculum to my student with significant needs. What would be the number one go-to place,
Number one.
or two or three, I don't know. Like where would you send them? Be like, okay, you need to go check this out.
Well, that's hard for me because I don't want to sound like I'm promoting me, but like and our company, but like that's what Keystone Assessment does. We help people build acceptability and to the standard. But if I had to point you to just one place, I don't know. There isn't just one place. There's so many places you can begin. You can begin with places like TASH and PEAK and the parent organizations. You can begin with places like CAST and UDL. You can begin with places such as the coalitions, the inclusive coalition, SWIFT is another great place. But if you're looking specifically for content, that is definitely harder. Looking at the two consortiums for content would be a place to start. Looking at the National Alternate Assessment Center, nacpartners.org, they have some really good trainings on how to align the content and what that might look like for students with significant cognitive disabilities. So I guess if I had to pick one, I would probably start with NAC because I just think they have some really powerful, good stuff out there.
Okay.
And they'll also lead you to a lot of other resources.
Excellent. Well, I'll try and put all of the links and the organizations that we talked about on the show notes page, so that when people listen to it, they can know where to find those things.
Awesome.
But once again, thank you, Debbie, for being
Thank
here.
you, Tim. This is great. And you're doing such fabulous work. I love getting your updates and seeing, the stories that you're sending and the research and pieces like that. It's been fabulous following you.
Well, it's my pleasure.
That concludes this edition of the Think Inclusive podcast. For more information about Debbie Taub, you can follow her on Twitter at DebbieTaub, or visit KeystoneAssessment.com for resources on how to make any content accessible. Remember, you can always find us on Twitter at Think_inclusive or on the web at thinkinclusive.us. Please visit our sponsor at brookspublishing.com and receive 25% off your order using the promo code TIMBD25. Today's show was produced by myself talking into USB headphones, a MacBook Pro, GarageBand, and a Skype account. Bumper music by Jose Galvez with the song Press. You can find it on iTunes. You can also subscribe to the Think Inclusive podcast via the iTunes Music Store or Podomatic.com, the largest community of independent podcasters on the planet. From Marietta, Georgia, please join us again on the Think Inclusive podcast. Thanks for your time and attention.